and welcome to this edition of the Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition podcast, sponsored by the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. I'm Brian O'Connor, adjunct professor of entrepreneurship at Chicago Booth. And joining me today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Graham Weaver. Graham is the founder of Alpine Investors, a unique people-driven private equity firm and lecturer in management at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Graham, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Brian, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Me too. Graham, why don't we get started? And if you would just share a bit with our listeners on the early days and the evolution of your firm. You started, as I understand it, as a $54 million fund one back in the early 2000s. And now you've grown this into an investment franchise, a highly accomplished firm with billions of dollars in assets under management. Tell us the story about how it all started and how it's evolved to what it is today.
Yeah, sure. So it actually started, my career in private equity started right out of undergrad. In 1994, I went to Wall Street and worked in private equity. And then from there, I went to Stanford Business School in 1997. And while I was there, I decided to try to buy some companies. The term fundless sponsor didn't exist back then, but if it had, that's kind of the best description of what I was. And I would go out and sign up these little rinky small label printing companies, and I financed them mostly with debt, and then the equity portion I didn't have money to do, so I used credit card debt and friends and family and scrounged for whoever I could get to invest. And that was actually how Alpine started. I named the firm Alpine because my house was on Alpine Road. And it was really funny because in the early days, sometimes brokers would say, wow, they named the street after your firm. That's pretty cool. You must be big time. And I was like, yep, you got it. We are big time. And by we, I mean me and myself and I. So then, you know, after I graduated, I was ready to, you know, continue on and start. But I got really nervous and really scared. And I listened to kind of all the voices in my head of fear and all the reasons I was going to fail. So I joined a bigger firm. It really wasn't a good fit for me. And so after about a year and a half, I left and started Alpine full time, launched a fund, as you said, Brian, in 2001, and took about a year to raise the first fund. We raised, as you said, $54 million. And then that was not a good fund. We lost money on a bunch of deals. That fund lost money overall. So it was really, it's really a tough way to start. I do not recommend having your first fund lose money. It just creates some headwinds. But we clawed our way back. We were able to raise a second fund. We had some phenomenal investors who were really, I owe a lot to those early investors. And we kept, you know, we had a decent fund two, good fund three, and then bam, we just got slammed with the Great Recession. We were just about to raise fund four, and then the recession, Lehman declared bankruptcy. So we went another 3 years with no fund. Had to drain my savings to make payroll during that time. And you know, at the time, it seemed like the worst thing that ever happened. And, you know, it was hard. But in hindsight, both the failure of Fund One and the time in the recession, those were the best things that happened to us because we really started looking internally and figuring out, you know, how to run our firm. What did we stand for? What made us unique? What made us special? Why were we going to win? And really all the interesting strategic things that we do, the differentiation, that all happened in that time frame, kind of from 2008 to 2011 or 12. You know, it was a really important period for us, as hard as it was. And then pretty much coming out of the recession, we had a really good playbook, and it centered around talent, which I'm sure we'll get into. We completely changed how we thought about the world. And we really today and for a while have just built our entire firm around people and talent. And once we started doing that, we just took off. And so, as you said, you know, now we manage over $8 billion. You know, our performance improved dramatically. And, you know, that was kind of how we got going.
Graham, what a cool story. I mean, there's so many questions that I have, and I want to come back to this period of 2008 to 2012. where you, there were probably some very hard lessons that y'all learned that are now really the core of your strategy and your differentiation. Let's come back to that. You mentioned in the early days, you had some investors that really stood by your side in a challenging environment. As a fund manager myself, I know that the results need to be there. And it sounds like you had some early support from some investors. Might you call some of those folks also mentors? Did you have any early career investor mentors or one or the other that you'd kind of point to? You don't need to name them specifically, or you can, but talk to me about those relationships and how those relationships looked, because it is a challenging endeavor to raise additional capital on the back of a pool of capital that wasn't performing according to plan.
Yeah. You know, when I first tried to raise Alpine One, I went to institutional investors, all the people you would think, schools and foundations and endowments. And that was a complete waste of time because I'm a 27-year-old with a very limited track record. And I would explain that to someone who was a vice president, and then they would explain it to their investment committee, and it would just go nowhere. So I changed my strategy, and I talked to individuals. And the thing I told myself is I need to talk to the person who's actually the decision maker. So that turned out to be, you know, high net worth folks and families. And I had one family and one individual that were really comprised most of my first three funds. And both of them were just amazing. I mean, I learned a lot from them, and they had been, you know, they've been doing this a long time. They understood sometimes things go well, sometimes they don't. And they really appreciated what we were doing and how we were making progress. And again, as I said, just the fact that they gave us a second chance and then a third chance was, you know, something I'll be forever grateful for.
That's amazing. I think it's a testament to probably a lot of the things that you were doing, communicating, working hard, despite maybe some need for modifications in your strategy. Let's get to that. So you cited the period of 2008 to 2012 as a big learning experience and a period of change and development for your firm. And my guess, Graham, is that's when you started to embody this notion of being a people-driven private equity firm and your people-first strategy, your operating philosophy that you have at Alpine. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. Well, what happened in 2009, I had a very just kind of lucky encounter with a guy named JP Flom, who was an executive coach. And JP, you know, in 2009, his business was not as robust as it had been as well. And so he gave me a really good deal to be my executive coach. And that was the first time I ever hired a coach. And JP also ran a firm that was focused on talent and assessment. He ran a firm called Green Peak, which was a GH Smart competitor. And so that was kind of his area of expertise. And, you know, a lot of our conversations were really centered around the people, not just the events. And so we had this really transformative conversation one time, I'll never forget it, where I was stressed and, you know, we were having this call. I tried to cancel our coaching call and I said, well, you know, JP, I got to fly to Dallas and fix this. And then I got to go to Chicago and fix this. I got to go to DC and fix this. And, you know, I won't replay the whole conversation, but basically he just coached me and asked me these questions. And at the root of every single fire I was extinguishing was a B or C player. So the, you know, a CEO who was a B or a C or someone on our team who was messing something up. And it was like, I was thinking the problems were all these macro things, whatever, but actually even in the recession, the real problem was, you know, we didn't have the right people in place. And that conversation just, it was like this light bulb went off and it never has it dimmed. And so I think that was the beginning. And then we looked at our track record to that point, and it was our very best deals were when we had backed typically our own CEO to go in. And at that time it was like by necessity, not by intention. So we had a company that wasn't doing well, we put in an Alpine person or someone we knew from our network or whatever. And then those deals ended up being our best deals. And then we kind of said, well, wait, maybe if you combine this talent thing with our track record, you know, maybe there's something here. And we really, you know, we really never looked back.
Yeah. So our listeners are probably starting to get the sense that, oh, wow, Graham might have been onto something as it relates to the sort of the asset class or investment model that has become what it is today around entrepreneurship through acquisition, search fund investing, and this people first model. So let's talk about that. So Graham, can you share with us some of the things that you saw in those troubled situations, specifically around some of the B and C players that might have been in critical roles, how you sort of identified the need to make a change and what you looked for in some of the early hires that got things back on track?
Well, I think that, you know, we've evolved our criteria quite a bit since then. But I think at the time, it was, you know, it was some pretty provocative coaching calls with JP where he would say, Graham, you know, give this person a grade. And I would give him like an A minus or something. And then we'd walk through it a little bit longer. And by the time I was done with the conversation, I'd say, oh, well, wait a second, maybe it's like a C. And then he would ask a question like, so are you going to build a world-class private equity firm with C players? Which I'm like, oh, of course, it's a rhetorical question. So first it was just shining a spotlight on the issue was the first part. And I had a blind spot. I just didn't even like think about that. And then what we say at Alpine is we hire for attributes over experience. We'll take both. We would prefer both. But if we had to make a choice, we're going to pick attributes. So that means we're looking for who someone is at their core, their grit, their horsepower, their will to win, their ability to get along with people, those kind of things, those attributes versus where they worked. And if you open up the aperture and think about attributes, you really widen the funnel for who could be awesome. And, you know, the class you teach is a great example. You're going to have graduates of MBA programs who have never run a business before. Maybe they've never even, we have people in our business who, you know, were professional athletes or in the military, and they've actually haven't even been in business, but they have these incredible attributes. And that has been a real winning formula for us.
Graham, so can you think back to that period in time where you spotlight sort of made all of these things aware to you? What were a couple of the transformative hires that you made? And then maybe I would ask you, how then did your role at that point in time, or maybe it was a few years following that, how did your role as the leader of the organization that Alpine is today, how did your role start to evolve, perhaps as a result of some of these transformative hires?
Well, one of the things I say to people is like, as soon as you hire an A-plus person, then your whole bar resets and you can't unsee greatness and you no longer have a lot of tolerance for a lot less than that. And we were very fortunate that we had, and I'll say a couple names, we had Josh Greenberg, Mike Duran, and Mark Strauch. They were running a couple of our companies at the time. And those board meetings were just insane. I mean, they were moving at lightning speed. They were crushing their numbers. There was like, you sat in that board meeting and you knew with 100% certainty they were going to win. And it was just a question of how big it was going to be and how much they won. And it was fun. We were on the same side of the table. And I was just like, what if we just did that? You know, why don't we just do that? And we pretty much have since then. And then at Alpine, we had a few of our early transformative hires as well that reset the bar. And again, we've never looked back. So I think it's kind of like just once you kind of see what great looks like, it's addictive, I guess, for lack of a better word.
So Graham, you're a prolific writer on the topic of building great teams and culture and again, this people first operating philosophy. You write a lot about partnering with great people, and you also write about parting ways with people when it's not working out. I mean, then this could be a very intimidating topic for early career operators. What advice might you give our listeners that are leading a small business, you know, on this topic of making key personnel changes. I mean, our listeners might be wrestling with this notion that firing is sort of a dirty word and might be in conflict with a people first operating philosophy that Alpine embodies.
Yeah, that's a great question, a great point. So the first thing I'm going to say is that it's the worst part of my job, and it is the hardest part. So I'll just start with that. And by the way, when we invest in businesses, we are going in with the idea of building them, growing them, hiring, adding sales, adding revenue. We are not cost cutters. That's just because it's just not fun. I avoid that at all costs. But this was advice from Irv Grossbeck, who's also a lecturer at Stanford, who's a mentor of mine and an investor in Alpine. And he says, look, as a leader, you have to prioritize the needs of the organization first, and then treat all the affected parties with grace and generosity and respect. But you have to do it in that order. Because everybody at the organization is relying on you to make those decisions. But the second part of it about the grace and generosity and respect, it opens the door for you to have, you know, almost a win-win conversation. Because if someone is really not performing, they're going home stressed and miserable. They're not going to progress in the organization. And if you can, you know, we vest people ahead of time. We give them time to find other jobs. We try everything we can to make sure they land on their feet. But we're not serving them by having them failing in their role. And we're certainly not serving the organization. Another thing I would say is that every instinct this is one area where your gut is going to lead you in the wrong direction. I'm a huge fan of leading with your heart and making decisions with your heart, not your head. This is maybe the only exception, because you will have a pit in your stomach and every part of you is going to resist this. Your life's going to get worse before it gets better, because you're going to have an empty seat. You're going to have a tough conversation. You're going to have severance. You're going to have on and on and on.
Very likely you'll have more on your plate as a result.
Exactly. You got to do a search and interview and all that. So this is probably the one place where you have to be kind of more intellectually honest about the situation than your gut. But just, I think it's helpful for people to understand that everything, all their instincts are going to be to not make those hard decisions, because that makes them even harder, you know, and to realize when you feel that way, that's normal.
Yeah. Graham, you brought up so many interesting insights there. And one that I'm trying to draw a parallel here with a topic that you also write a lot about around self-discovery and self-awareness. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit and what role that might play in these really tough decisions and that you just described around making personnel change. And maybe for the listeners that might not be as familiar with your work on this topic of self-discovery, you know, maybe we start with, you know, what does self-discovery mean to you, and how might the leader of a small business or a searcher that envisions themselves being the leader of a small business and hopefully soon will be, how might they think about this topic that you explore around self-discovery?
Yeah, it is an area I have a lot of passion for. My blog is grahamweaver.com if you're interested in more. But I remember when I was young, I used to listen to audio tapes that were kind of like self-help tapes on my Sony Walkman when it mowed the lawn. And I really became interested and quite piqued by this idea of self-discovery. And it was really influential in my life. And I remember one of the authors said back then was 99% of people actually don't take the time to figure out what they want. So said a different way, only 1% of people like take the time, figure out what they want, have clear written goals, and then work toward that. That's 1%. And I just remember thinking, that's amazing, you know? And so the first part of self-discovery really is that it's just like, it's such a simple question. What do you want? But what do you want in your relationship, in your life, in your career? What do you want in this particular situation? What do you want for yourself? How do you want to show up? who are you when you're at your best? I mean, that simple question, like, you know, mushrooms into your whole life and being intentional about living it in a way that's consistent with what you want. The best hack, for lack of a better word, that I've found is to have an executive coach. I've talked to a coach every week or every other week, sometimes multiple times a week since 2009. I told you about the transformative conversations with JP, and that's basically what we do. You know, it's like, what are the, I mean, they ask, they're, you know, they're very skilled, so they're asking the question in lots of different ways, but we're basically saying, what's your intention and are you moving toward that? What's getting in your way? And finding out your true intention takes time. It's not like you do a 1 hour exercise and all of a sudden you're clear for the rest of your life. You gotta actually make some space and time to ask that question. But it is the most important question. You know, it's whatever, I think it was Thoreau said, an unexamined life is not worth living in. And it's worth investing a few hours a week just really thinking about what you want for yourself.
And Graham, do you believe that in doing so and getting, you know, sort of a journey and not a destination, but, you know, if you truly are understanding of your, you know, your true intentions, your true goals, setting aside time to do that, documenting them, do you think that some of these big and seemingly daunting decisions around key hires or parting ways with some of the that might not be working out, do those as a result become a little bit more manageable? And it's not to say that they aren't still very hard and very, you know, sinking feeling in your gut, but do they become more clear and more sort of easy to arrive at a conclusion where you might otherwise be stuck?
Yeah, for sure they do. Because really when you're stressed about something, a big decision, it's almost always because you have two core values of yours that are in conflict. So if I am stressed about, I have to let someone close to me go or someone that I've worked with, you know, there's two real key values there, which is I need to do, you know, I need to be a great leader of Alpine and I care a lot about that person. And to just have the recognition of that's why it's causing me stress, then you can kind of solve for it and say, well, I care about this person. So how do I do this in a way that really cares for them and really honors them and really gives them a way that I can, you know, make this work for them as well. And so just the, again, the intention is really helpful. And the other thing I would say about the benefit of spending time on this is think about when your energy is moving you toward your greatest intention and your thing that's most important, like you just unlock all kinds of energy and kind of power, for lack of a better word, because there's nothing in the way there. And a lot of the times when we're operating, you know, think of a normal day, we're just come in, we have back-to-back Zoom calls, we have emails we're returning, we check social media, whatever. Like that's a stressful day because it's not clear that any of that is actually moving us toward the things that are important to us. And, right. And when that same day is moving us exactly in the direction where we want to go, it's an energizing day. And so it really is important to kind of just spend the time to figure that out.
Yeah, I think we all have those days where we just sort of feel like we're in flow and things are working. And I think that's right. I think it's because we've been intentional about our goals and our intentions. And we've all had those days where it's like, you know, I feel like I'm buried by my email inbox and I feel like I can't catch up. And those days tend to be the days where we're not as clear about, you know, what our goals and objectives and true intentions are. I think that's a really great lesson for maybe the early career operators that are listening to this podcast and trying to figure out, you know, what fire to put out next, you know? So,
well, just, and one more thing I'll say, Brian, is for the early career operators or even the late career operators, imagine this in an organization now, you know, imagine you know, what your clarity or lack thereof is cascading down through your entire organization. So if you can give that same clarity to your whole organization and set up processes where others can get that same clarity, you can give that gift to everyone in your company and have them feel the same way, that they're, you know, they're not waking up and just working on random stuff and, you know, all over the place, but they know exactly where you're going, where they need to be going. I mean, that's basically what leadership is.
And what a wonderful gift that is to give to your team. I mean, it truly is. So that's a really nice segue, Graham. And I want to be mindful of time here. We're sort of getting short on time. But how did you grow and scale that? I mean, because I'm getting the sense that the last several minutes of our conversation are really kind of at the core of what Alpine is and the culture that you've established and has been perpetuated over the years. How does that grow and scale? I can envision a world where it's Graham and a handful of key deputies and a small team, and that's easier. But you've grown this into a world-class investing organization. How has that all grown and scaled?
Yeah, at some point, I had to make a decision that this is for me personally, that I wasn't going to define my success at Alpine by what deals I worked on. And, you know, for the first, I don't even know, 15 plus years of my career, that was the only metric. And then over time, I had to let go of that and define my success by how did Alpine do? You know, how was our firm doing? And giving myself permission to spend my energy on that. So that was the first part. And that it sounds like that's easy, but it's very hard to let go where you get to the end of the quarter and say, I did that deal and that deal, and this is my track record and whatever. And so that was part one, was just kind of letting go of that. And then it's kind of like, okay, if you let go of that, now what is the most important thing that I do as a leader? And it is attracting incredible people. And even more important than that is making sure that this is the place where they want to spend their careers. And the hard thing about hiring amazing people is they have very big aspirations. Like, a lot of them want my job, which is great. And they want, you know, they want something new every 6 months. And so that is a big challenge. And I spend a ton of my time on that. And then the part about goal setting, I think that's something we're pretty good at. We have it pretty institutionalized. We have a one-page plan. We have quarterly offsites. We have half-day departmental offsites. We, you know, we have a whole process around that. I won't say that's easy, but that's been kind of built into the sort of Alpine playbook. But the ability to keep the right people and make this a place where they want to work, that's the hardest part of my job. And that's the most fun part. And it's the part that is the most important too.
Well, it seems like you've been able to effectively scale that. And listen, I know that some days might feel like it's working perfectly, and other days it might not, but in aggregate, at least from my perspective, Graham, it seems like, and probably to a lot of our listeners, that you've been able to effectively grow and scale that, which you could envision a scenario where it would become diluted over time. And clearly that has not happened.
Yeah, I think the thing that I come back to is, what's the firm that I would have wanted to work at if I were, you know, coming out of undergrad or coming out of business school? Like, what would I want to be true, and try to create that as much as I can? And that's been a good formula in general. It feels like for the most part, we're able to do that.
Graham, because our listeners are very inquisitive and growing minds, can you share a favorite book and why you like it so much with our listeners?
Good question. Can I give you a couple?
You can. Absolutely.
I'll give you one that's probably not obvious for folks. There's two amazing books by Dan and Chip Heath. Their best known one is called Made to Stick, which is phenomenal. It's about generating a message and making it clear. I actually think if you read it a different way, it's about strategy. They would maybe not say that, but that's how I take it. It's a phenomenal book. They have another one, which I like even better, which is called Switch. And that's about how to get organizations to move and do kind of make changes. Awesome book. There's some of the most powerful chapters, particularly the one on scaling bright spots. Maybe the best chapter in any book I've ever read. And then I would say, I mean, Jim Collins, you know, all his books are great. I think it's chapter 3 in Good to Great, where he talks about, you know, getting the right people on the bus and the wrong people off the bus. like literally we took every single thing. I read that book 20 years ago. We do every single thing he says in that book. It's just that good. Everything in that book is good. And his other books that don't get as much attention are phenomenal. I mean, I could go on and on, but I got one more, which is How to Win Friends and Influence People, the Dale Carnegie classic. If you haven't read it, like literally get it right now. Download it, listen to it, or if on audio, however you consume material, because it is life changing.
I love those. No, those are amazing recommendations. A favorite leader and why you might look up to that person.
I'm going to go with Abraham Lincoln on this one.
Honest Abe. Okay.
And it's not for the reason you might think. The fact that he pretty much, I won't say single-handedly, but abolished slavery, kept the Union together. You know, you put anyone else in position at that time, we'd probably have a different nation. But what I really love about him is all the setbacks and failures and face plants that he had along the way. And he just kept getting up. He was like the Terminator. You couldn't stop him. And I in some of my classes, I list off the 15 different setbacks he had in his life. And I think that's actually why he was that leader. And so I just love the story. It's just inspirational.
Very cool. Final question. And I think I have a sense for the answer to this one, but let's play it out. What gets you excited to come to work and do what you do every day? And maybe the curveball on that is like, do you envision that being the same thing 5, 10, 20 years from now?
Well, I mean, I'm living, you know, Brian, I'm living my dream. I mean, I'm working with the most amazing people in the world, really, every day, like right next to me every single day. And we're having a really big impact on the world. We're winning. You know, we're innovating. We're coming up with new ideas. You know, we have in many ways a blank canvas. I mean, it's the greatest job ever. And I get excited about every part of it. It doesn't mean every day's bliss. There's, you know, we have our moments like anyone else, but in general, I'm just super blessed. And if I had to say one thing, it's just the team that we have. It's just, they're the people I would back in any situation, but they're also, you know, my closest friends. So it's, just very blessed to have that opportunity.
Graham, this has been an amazing conversation. I can't thank you enough for investing your time and your insights into all of our listeners and the followers of the podcast. And on behalf of the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship at Chicago Booth and all of our listeners worldwide, I just want to thank you so much for sharing and your generosity.
It was my pleasure, Brian. Keep doing what you're doing. I love it. And I hope we'll stay in touch. Thanks for having me.
We will indeed. Thank you, Graham.